Good morning. Ukraine wants full NATO membership. Russia doesn't want any NATO presence in Ukraine. Is there a compromise that could still guarantee Ukraine's security? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. After a shooter attacked the CDC, hundreds of federal health workers say Secretary RFK Jr. needs to do more to protect them. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Michelle Martin. They say his, quote, deceitful statements, unquote, contributed to the violence. And Margaret Qualley on playing a private eye in the new film, Honey, Don't. It is Thursday, August 21st. On this day in 1944, representatives of the U.S., Great Britain, the Soviet Union, and China met at Dunbarton Oaks in Washington, D.C. to draw up plans for an organization that became the United Nations. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Hurricane Erin is just starting to move away from the North Carolina coast. The storm never made landfall, but its outer winds triggered tropical storm warnings from North Carolina's Outer Banks to southern Virginia. Rip currents on the shore are the biggest danger. North Carolina Governor Josh Stein warns stay out of the water at all costs.
Don't do it. You do not know how deep the water is or how fast it is running.
Rip currents are a threat all the way up to New England. These dangers will persist all day, even though Hurricane Erin is pulling away from the East Coast. It's a Category 2 storm with top sustained winds of 105 miles per hour. The Texas State House has passed a Republican plan to redraw congressional districts in that state. The GOP hopes to send five more Republicans to the U.S. House from Texas in midterm elections next year. Texas Democrats fled their state to try to block this plan, but they returned after a couple of weeks. The measure now goes to the Texas State Senate. A federal judge in Texas has temporarily blocked a new state law requiring the Ten Commandments be posted in every public school classroom. From Texas Public Radio, Gabrielle Alerta Solorio has more.
U.S. District Court Judge Fred Beery held that Texas State Senate Bill 10 more than likely violates both the Establishment and Free Exercise Clauses of the First Amendment. Plaintiff Rabbi Mara Nathan argued children's religious beliefs should be instilled by parents and faith communities, not politicians and public schools. The bill was signed into law by Governor Greg Abbott in June and was supposed to go into effect on June 1st. The ruling only applies to the 11 districts listed in the lawsuit. The plaintiffs hope additional schools will adhere to the judge's ruling. I'm Gabriela Alcorta Solorio in San Antonio.
President Trump's Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, says she will cut her office's budget by over 40%. NPR's Jenna McLaughlin reports this is one of Gabbard's latest efforts to reorganize the intelligence community hub.
Career intelligence officials say their mission is to speak truth to power. However, the former Democratic lawmaker turned head of the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, or ODNI, has expressed her commitment to aligning the agency with President Trump's policy goals. The ODNI was created after the September 11th terrorist attacks to foster intelligence sharing between U.S. government agencies. Gabbard says she'll slash the agency's costs by over 40% by the end of September, though she didn't identify specific cuts. In a statement, the Democratic vice chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Mark Warner of Virginia, says he would welcome the chance to review Gabbard's plans, but expresses concern, arguing Gabbard has a track record of politicizing intelligence. Jen McLaughlin, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The Israeli government has given its final approval to a plan to build thousands of new homes in the West Bank. Israel's far-right finance minister approved the plan, saying it will, quote, erase any idea of a Palestinian state. The building will commence east of Jerusalem. The construction would slice the West Bank into two parts. The number of West Bank settlements continues to grow despite international condemnation. The upcoming Broadway season will feature some well-known stars from TV and film. A couple of revivals have been announced. The formula worked well last season. Jeff London explained several revivals were the most popular tickets all year.
In December, Carrie Coon, who starred in both The White Lotus and The Gilded Age on HBO this season, will headline in a revival of the off-Broadway hit Bug, a tense thriller which is almost 30 years old. It's by Tracy Letts, Kuhn's husband. In March, two Golden Globe winners, film and television actor Don Cheadle and Ayo Edebiri, who recently starred in The Bear, make their Broadway debuts as a father and daughter in Proof. The 2001 Pulitzer Prize-winning play by David Auburn receives its first Broadway revival. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
Retired Rhode Island Municipal Judge Frank Caprio has died of pancreatic cancer, according to his family on social media accounts. He was 88 years old. He gained fame online for his work in the courtroom. Caprio was often seen displaying kindness and compassion. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. This is NPR.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
In 1905, William Williams was convicted of murdering a St. Paul teen and his mother. In 1906, he was sentenced to die by hanging. This was Minnesota's last execution because a botched hanging made public by aggressive news reporting shifted public opinion. At the time, the press was banned from covering executions due to the John Day Smith Law, frequently called the Midnight Assassination Law. It required private nighttime execution of prisoners in order to banish crowds. Reporter Joseph Hennessy, writing for the St. Paul Daily News, snuck in and witnessed the gruesome hanging and wrote about William's agonizing death.
The sheriff had miscalculated the length of the rope, and so William Williams fell through the scaffold trap. His feet hit the floor, and it took about 14 minutes for him to die by strangulation.
That's historian Michael Anderson, detailing what should have been an instant death. Despite this ban on reporting, the St. Paul Pioneer Press, the St. Paul Dispatch, and the St. Paul Daily News carried the story with the gory details. The newspapers were fined $25 each, but the accounts were enough to cause public outcry over capital punishment. And in 1911, lawmakers outlawed the practice.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Senior Pentagon officials have been meeting their counterparts in Europe this week.
The mission is to work out security guarantees for Ukraine to help end the current war with Russia and prevent a future one. This effort comes as Russia unleashed one of its largest ever airstrikes overnight.
For more, we're joined by NPR's Greg Myrie in Ukraine's capital, Kyiv. Greg, good morning to you.
Hi, Michelle.
To start, tell us what ideas the U.S. and European countries are kicking around.
Yeah, President Trump asked the chairman of the Pentagon's Joint Chiefs, Air Force General Dan Kane, to develop plans for security guarantees for Ukraine, but any U.S. role would likely be limited to some form of air support. Trump is clear he doesn't want U.S. troops on the ground in Ukraine, even as peacekeepers after the war ends. Now, General Kane is talking to European defense officials. Some European countries say they could send troops at some future point, but I really want to stress this is all very preliminary right now. The war is still raging. Russia carried out one of its largest ever airstrikes overnight, more than 600 drones and missiles, and President Volodymyr Zelensky said this includes a Russian cruise missile that hit an American electronics factory. More than a dozen people were wounded. This plant, which makes civilian electronics, is in an isolated part of far western Ukraine. We're trying to get more details.
What's the view in Ukraine on possible security guarantees?
Yeah, Ukrainians just aren't holding their breath. They think Russian leader Vladimir Putin wants to keep fighting. They say that any Western security promises really need to be ironclad. I spoke with Alexander Mereshko, a member of parliament who heads the Foreign Affairs Committee.
I strongly continue to believe that the only solution is NATO membership for Ukraine. This would stop the war. This would stop Putin's aggression because Putin is afraid of only one thing, NATO.
So many Ukrainians do feel this way. Ukraine was promised a path to NATO membership way back in 2008. It hasn't gone anywhere, and Trump says it's not going to happen now. Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, has talked about a guarantee that could be something like NATO's Article 5, which says an attack on one is an attack on all. But Ukraine has had these limited security promises in the past, and that hasn't stopped Russia from invading. It wants something much stronger this time.
Any sign Russia would accept any type of Western troop presence or NATO guarantee for Ukraine?
Russia is really a hard no on this. Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, repeated the country's position that Russia should have veto power over security guarantees for Ukraine, which would make any guarantees essentially worthless. Russia's always rejected a NATO presence in Ukraine, and that's really one of the main reasons Putin launched this war, to make sure Western troops didn't move closer to Russia's borders.
So given that Ukraine and Russia have these polar opposite positions, is there any way forward?
Well, right now, it's hard to see any middle ground. Again, here's Alexander Mereshko, the member of parliament.
At present moment, interests and positions, stances of Ukraine and Russia are diametrically opposed, and they cannot be reconciled.
And really, just one final note, Michelle, this flurry of diplomacy is seen a little bit differently from this end. There is high interest, but just lots of skepticism. They just don't see Russia, or Ukraine for that matter, hinting at any major concessions.
That is NPR's Greg Myrie in Kyiv. Greg, thank you.
Sure thing, Michelle.
For another view of next steps for the U.S. and European nations, let's turn to Richard Haass. He's president emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the Substack newsletter Home and Away. Good morning and welcome back to the program.
Good to be with you, Layla.
So, Richard, you wrote recently that a security guarantee that involves Ukraine giving up land creates risks. And that looks like exactly what may be being asked here. What are the risks that you see?
One risk is simply the precedent. Essentially, it rewards aggression. One of the principal rules, some would say the only real rule in the world, Layla, is that territory cannot be acquired by military force. And this would seem to violate that. And then secondly, the question is what Russia, you know, what land would Russia get where it could potentially put forces there, which would then give it a forward area from which to threaten the rest of Ukraine. So it's not clear to me why this would be part of any peace plan.
So are you saying that this sort of peace plan has gotten off to a very flawed start from the beginning? Because this is something that we heard pretty much since the Alaska meeting happened.
Yeah, I have real doubts about it. In part, it's one-sided. People use the phrase land swaps or transfers, but it all seems in one direction, from Ukraine to Russia. I don't see that Russia is being asked to give anything up. I think more broadly also, this is the sort of issue that save for what we call in diplomacy final status talks, questions of territory, questions of populations, these really thorny fundamental questions. My biggest issue right now is why did President Trump, when he met in Alaska, with President Putin, why did he switch from pushing for a ceasefire for pushing for a final durable peace? This is far more demanding. It would take much more time. It brings in all these difficult issues. I think the smartest approach would be to get a ceasefire and shelve some of these issues where, quite honestly, as you just heard, the gap between Russia and Ukraine is enormous.
Let's talk about that gap. I mean, we just heard that many of Ukraine's leaders want full NATO membership. They feel that's the only way to deter Putin. Russia doesn't want any NATO presence there. Is there any way to reach a compromise given these completely opposite positions?
Well, I am skeptical, but also it would take enormous time, and that means the war continues. And we've seen that in the last 24 hours. So even if Russia and Ukraine were both negotiating in good faith, it essentially would mean, you know, months more of war while these issues were hammered out. So again, maybe my skepticism is misplaced, but then I'd say let's nail down a ceasefire almost without getting into any of these issues. Just stop the fighting without prejudice. No one has to give up on any of their territorial or other claims. And then you could begin a process of trying to negotiate these very difficult long-term issues.
There's very little we actually know about this idea of a U.S. security guarantee, right? What would it look like for Ukraine other than President Trump mentioning air support? To what extent do you think the U.S. should be involved in Ukraine as part of any future security deal?
I believe the single most important thing we can and should do is to make a long-term pledge to provide Ukraine the means, the military and intelligent means, to defend itself. That is the principal security assurance we should be making. It's what Ukraine needs. It also sends the message to Vladimir Putin that more time and more war will not give him more results. That is what we should be doing. I actually agree with President Trump. I don't think there's a place for boots on the ground. And assurances outside of NATO raise as many questions as they answer. So I would think the critical thing is for the United States, and here I'd say Congress should get involved. Why don't we have Congress back it as a matter of law to provide a long-term commitment to Ukraine's security?
A lot of people who know Russia well question Vladimir Putin's intentions here and whether he's serious about ending this war at all. What do you think the U.S. should do if there's no ceasefire, and if Vladimir Putin just continues this war and his ambitions to take as much of Ukraine as possible?
Well, people should be skeptical of Putin's ambitions. He put them out on paper 6 months or so before he invaded Ukraine in 3.5 years ago. He really wants to eliminate Ukraine as an independent sovereign country with ties to the West. We should be pressuring Russia with sanctions if it doesn't act reasonably. And more important, we should be committing ourselves to Ukraine's defense. Put on the table a long-term arms and intelligence support policy of Ukraine. That would get Putin's attention more than anything else.
That's Richard Haass, President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
In a letter to their boss, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., federal health workers are asking him to do more to ensure their safety. This after a shooting this month on the CDC campus in Atlanta. NPR's Ping Wong has more.
On August 8th, Dr. Fiona Havers, a former CDC official, texted frantically with friends and colleagues taking shelter during the shooting.
There were more than 500 rounds fired at a federal government building with hundreds of people inside, including 90 children in a daycare that the bullets were flying over as they hit CDC's buildings.
The shooter was motivated by his discontent with COVID vaccines. CDC staff consider this the largest attack on federal workers since the Oklahoma City bombings and the January 6th riots at the Capitol. Dr. Elizabeth Soda is a physician at the CDC. She signed a letter to the HHS secretary in Congress expressing, quote, grave concern for America's health and security.
The environment was just right for something like this to happen.
The letter, signed by more than 750 people, says Kennedy has taken dangerous and deceitful actions that have contributed to harassment and violence. Soda says, speaking for herself and not the agency,
how do you call us a cesspool of corruption and then go on to lead us effectively?
Kennedy visited the CDC campus after the shooting and says ensuring worker safety and well-being is a top priority. But in an interview with Scripps News after the attack, Kennedy said public health workers had overreached in encouraging COVID vaccination.
The public health agencies have not been honest. No matter how well-intentioned it is to tell a noble lie to get an outcome that you want, it never works over the long time.
In a statement responding to NPR's request for comment, HHS says conflating, quote, widely supported public health reforms with the violence of a suicidal mass shooter is an attempt to politicize a tragedy. Ian Morgan also signed the letter. He says the attack on CDC affects all federal workers. He works at the National Institutes of Health in Maryland, and in his personal view,
we've seen this increase in police presence, and we've seen this increase in security, and that's great. But when you have people from the top who are putting a target on your back, how can you possibly feel safe going to work every day?
The letter also asks Kennedy to stop spreading inaccurate health information and to stand up for CDC science. Ping Huang, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Hey, thanks for listening to your public radio station, which brings you Morning Edition, the most popular radio news program in the United States, where you get voices of people in the news and reports from around the world. We know you have millions of options to get somebody's opinion on the news, millions of options for a take on the news, but few options where you can get people who dig up facts and go to the scene to look and give you the information to make your decision. And this public radio station is the place for that, where you get NPR News.
This public radio station is KAXE. We are people-powered. We are not governed by algorithms or corporations. We are governed by people, people like you. We need you to join us and keep us people-powered. Text the word DONATE to 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton, and I thank you for your support.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs. With online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses at easycater.com. From UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services, dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG. Our purpose is people. And from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Layla Faldin. In Honey Don't, Margaret Qualley stars as a private detective. She's investigating a mysterious death that's somehow connected to this cultish church in Central California, led by an egomaniac pastor played by Chris Evans.
What can you tell me about
her? Do you drink?
Heavily. It's a point of pride. What can you tell me about
her? Should you and I discuss this over a drink?
No. This is business. What can you tell me about
her? After business.
Tuesdays I dry out.
It's the second volume in a trilogy of playful, pulpy lesbian films directed by Ethan Coen and co-written with his wife, Trisha Cook. I spoke with Qualley about this film, and I started by asking what it was that drew her to this character.
I was super excited by the idea of doing something that was like completely opposite to what I was doing at that time, like especially from a physicality POV, just couldn't be more polar opposites.
How did you prepare for the role of Honey when you thought about this character in Bakersfield, California, who dresses in wrap dresses and heels and pencil skirts and talks like a 1950s film star?
Yeah. Well, that was the thing you just said was a lot of it, right? Like, it says in the script that her voice is smooth like Honey. And I'm like, okay, well, my voice is not smooth like Honey. Like, I gotta figure that out. But I watched a lot of, you know, Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall were both really big inspirations. So I watched.
Oh, I can see that.
A lot of old movies, The Long Goodbye. At the time that those movies were made, it wasn't so much about art imitates life, from what I understand. There was more of an aspirational quality to Hollywood that I think has evolved and gone in and out of style over the years. But I think this film is an ode to those kind of aspirational tones where it is a bit heightened and not entirely reality-based.
You are, like, central to your character is you're a lesbian in the movie and you're in this tryst with Aubrey Plaza, who is a cop. Mm-hmm. What is different about these two women and what unites them?
I think that their attraction as characters is kind of feeling like they've met their match, you know, like two people that usually feel like they're in the power seat, kind of competing for that power seat. I won't say too much more because
you don't want to give too much away.
Yeah.
There's some plot twists.
There's some plot twists for sure. But it was such a joy to work with Aubrey.
Address you wanted?
Thanks, MG.
Honey, right? Love those click-clacking heels.
This year's a big year for you. Also, I don't even know how you have time for this interview based on all the stuff that you're doing. You have four films out this year. It does feel like You really are having a moment.
Thank you. I feel really lucky to be able to do what I love to do for a living. And, you know, I'm just still figuring it out.
Yeah.
What do you love about this, about acting, about jumping into different characters and being totally different people?
I think I have a strange learning curve because I didn't start acting because I love movies. I started acting because I quit dancing.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And I started watching a lot of movies at like 18 years old when I was becoming serious about acting. But it's probably taken me 10 years to really like understand what it means to make a movie beyond just, you know, trying to be there and be present.
When I was watching this and thinking about, you know, I had the last thing I watched you in was Substance, which was such an incredible film. You had a Golden Globe nomination for it and explored this obsession society has and we have with being young and beautiful. And I just thought, how do you choose the roles that you do choose? Because they're all so complex and they explore different aspects of what being a woman is.
I put a lot of pressure on myself to make the right decisions about things, and I haven't always made the right decisions. And sometimes I get to a job and I'm like, nope, I didn't do this one right.
Is there anything where you're like, why did I do this?
Of course, yeah, like for sure. I'm trying to do stuff where I'm able to work stuff out for myself in the process, you know?
You don't seem to be afraid of trying anything, or you don't seem afraid of leaning into different types of characters, whether they're like you or different than you in real life, whether it's based in reality or on a totally different planet. Is there anything that does scare you that you wouldn't try?
Thank you. I'm 30 years old. I think I'm just now arriving at the point where I might have more limitations, you know?
Have you always felt like you just have to say yes to things?
You said that I'm not afraid, and I said thank you. So I think that I've had pride in my recklessness. Mm. The older I get, the more precious I realize life is, and the more intention I have with being careful, and the more attractive I find it to be careful and considerate.
What do you mean by careful?
Just like to take care of yourself, you know?
Yeah.
Like not wanting to do something that might hurt me, because why?
Yeah. I really hear you.
Yeah.
I mean, I know in my career, totally different career, but there are times where I would say yes to anything, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, you want me to go cover this war and there's no protection and there's not, no problem.
I'm your girl. Yeah.
I'm on it.
Yeah.
And now in my 40s, I'm quite a bit older than you. I definitely am more discerning.
Yeah. I think, you know, especially when you have that hunger for a job and you're willing to say, I'll do anything, right? Like you can count on, I'm a daredevil. I don't care. I'm not scared. Like, that's a winning attitude when you're trying to get ahead sometimes, but it doesn't, you know, sometimes has repercussions.
That's Margaret Qualley. She plays the lead role in Ethan Coen's latest film, Honey Don't. Thank you, Margaret. This was a joy.
Yeah, thank you so much. I love talking to you. No, honey, don't.
This is NPR News.
Despite her success, Kathleen Edwards took a break from the music industry to run a coffee shop. That time away turned out to be the spark for loving music again.
There's something really empowering about the pursuit of something because you really love it and you have people around you who are on board with you.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Kathleen Edwards' new album, Billionaire, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I almost shouted your name out loud.
All Things Considered starts at 4 o'clock here on People Powered KAXE with your local host, Andrew DeZingle. Good morning. It is 5:29. I'm Jennifer Barr. Thanks so much for listening to the Thursday morning show on KAXE. Coming up at 6:20, Jeff Sundin, our early bird fishing guide. And in just a few moments, our daily dose of phenology, John Latimer looks back at his nature notes for this date, August 21st. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets 6 p.m. Monday, August 25th at KBXC in Bemidji. This is an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxc.org or you can call 218-326-1234 during business hours. Regular meetings of our Board of Directors are held the fourth Monday of the month, and the board's meeting schedule is available at kaxc.org. Mostly sunny today with highs in the low to mid 80s, winds from the south up to 15 miles per hour. Showers possible overnight with lows near 60, and for tomorrow mostly sunny, a bit cooler, highs in the mid 70s. Winds from the west up to 20 miles per hour. Lauron Presbyterian Church invites you to their 34th annual Carnival this Saturday from 11 to 2. The church is located on Scenic Highway 7 north of Taconite. Enjoy corn on the cob, barbecue sandwiches, and more. There's also a silent auction, live music, and a bake sale. The Central Lakes College Ag and Energy Research Center has its annual field day Friday, August 29th from 9 to 3 at their site in Staples. It is a day of hands-on demonstrations, education sessions, local food, and more. Find a schedule at clcagandenergy.org/events. Thanks for choosing KAXC this morning. It's time for our daily dose of phenology.
On today's date, August 21st, in the year 2000, I hear a gray tree frog calling. It takes me a while to identify it. I'm thinking, what bird is that? Why am I hearing a bird calling right now? Fall is hardly the time for bird calls. There are a few, the eastern peewee, sometimes a red-eyed vireo, but very little else in the way of bird calls in the fall. And this persistent call kept tickling my ear and making me wonder, who the heck is doing all this singing? Well, it took a while, and then finally I realized that the song wasn't moving around. If it was a bird, it was cemented to one spot. And that tripped the trigger in my brain that said, wait a minute, that's not a bird at all. It's the gray tree frog. And something about the timing of the day, the number of hours of daylight, whatever, tripped a hormonal trigger within the gray tree frog and made it think that it was time to start calling for a suitor.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from AG1, maker of a drinkable multivitamin now available in three new flavors, tropical, berry, and citrus. Learn more at drinkag1.com. From Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at viking.com. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Israel is moving ahead with a new mission to take control of Gaza City.
The Israeli military is calling up tens of thousands of soldiers, and the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has ordered military officials to speed up preparations to seize Gaza's biggest city. At the very same time, Israel is considering a new offer for a two-month ceasefire with Hamas.
NPR's Daniel Estrin is on the line from Tel Aviv to tell us more about this. Good morning, Daniel.
Good morning, Michelle.
So can you just help us make sense of this? What direction is Israel heading in here? A ceasefire or expanding the war and taking territory?
Israel is giving off contradictory signals. On the one hand, the military yesterday called up 60,000 new reservist soldiers. They're to report for duty beginning in September, and that will bring the total number to 120,000 mobilized reservists. That's a huge number. The plan is to encircle Gaza City, send soldiers in, and then later on send soldiers to central Gaza. These are the last major areas Israel has not yet taken over because it's where hostages are believed to be held. At the same time, there is a ceasefire offer on the table since Monday. Egypt and Qatar finally got Hamas to accept that offer without any changes, and now the ball is in Israel's court, and Israel has not yet replied. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has put out statements that suggest Israel does not like the offer. Hostage families, people who have loved ones held in Gaza, are calling on Israel to accept the deal on the table, not to carry out the Gaza City operation that could endanger their loved ones in Gaza. There were major protests earlier this week calling for a deal with Hamas. And so Israel finds itself at a major crossroads in the war, and it has not decided what strategic direction to take.
If Israel does go ahead with plans to capture Gaza City, what would that look like, and what's the military objective?
Well, Israel sees Gaza City as a major stronghold of Hamas. Soldiers are already beginning to carry out strikes on the outskirts of the city as kind of initial steps of beginning this new operation. It would be a major offensive, and it would be very complex. It would entail Israel ordering the displacement of many hundreds of thousands of Palestinians to southern Gaza near the Egyptian border, and aid groups are warning that would only exacerbate the humanitarian crisis. And it also makes Egypt very nervous about Palestinians streaming potentially across the border into Egypt. It would also be a very tough fight. And there was a rare incident in southern Gaza yesterday that provided a preview of what may come. There were more than 15 Hamas militants who stormed an Israeli military outpost in southern Gaza. One soldier was severely wounded, according to Israel. And Israel estimates it was an attempt to take a soldier hostage. So that just shows that Hamas does have guerrilla units and does have battlefield motivation. But Michelle, this might not be an either or, either a Gaza City offensive or a ceasefire deal. Israeli media are quoting the defense minister as saying in a closed forum that just starting the ground operation in Gaza City and entering the city could force Hamas to agree to a more comprehensive ceasefire and hostage deal.
So, Darren, before we let you go, what is the ceasefire deal on the table and why would Israel not accept it?
They are the same terms that the U.S. had actually proposed weeks ago. It would be a 60-day ceasefire. Hamas would release half of the hostages. There'd be a surge of humanitarian aid to Gaza, where the world's experts on hunger and famine say famine is unfolding. But Israel is now publicly demanding all the hostages in Gaza be released, not half. And so Netanyahu is under the same political pressure. If he agrees to kind of a ceasefire deal now, his far-right political partners could topple his government.
That is NPR's Daniel Estrin in Tel Aviv. Daniel, thank you.
You're welcome.
Hurricane Erin remains well offshore as a Category 2 storm, but its massive size and strength means it's already disrupting life on the Atlantic coast.
North Carolina Governor Josh Stein gave his own brief but very clear warning.
No one should be in the ocean.
Forecasters continue to warn of potential coastal flooding, high winds, and life-threatening rip currents from the Carolinas to New Jersey.
Will Michaels has been monitoring the storm's impact from member station WUNC in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So what are you seeing in North Carolina? Where is Hurricane Erin having its greatest impacts?
This storm has been hitting the famous Outer Banks. So if you look at a map of the East Coast, of course, you'll see these islands kind of bulge out into the Atlantic. And so they're often subject to the impacts of these storms, even if they don't make landfall. There's only one main road on the Outer Banks, and a huge portion of it is closed. The storm surge breached protective sand dunes last night, and the road is underwater. Most buildings there, oceanfront buildings, are on stilts, and so we're seeing photos and videos from business owners of water coming up the shore and underneath those buildings. Two islands, Ocracoke and Hatteras, were under mandatory evacuations. We know most people listened to those warnings and left, but the National Weather Service expects ongoing storm surge as high as 4 feet through tonight, and they call this a prolonged event, so that means even after the storm leaves, it could be a few days before the water level returns to normal.
Well, how prepared is North Carolina for this type of storm?
The coast has plenty of experience with flooding, but has to deal with it more often. We know that climate change has accelerated beach erosion and washed away dunes in many areas. So when we have exceptionally high tides, low-lying areas that were once protected are now more likely to flood. And it's also worth pointing out that it's not just happening on the coast. North Carolina is still recovering from Helene, which tore through the western part of the state almost a year ago. Then Chantal flooded parts of central North Carolina this year over the 4th of July weekend, and both of those were deadly storms. And Governor Josh Stein said the state is still waiting on $100 million in reimbursements from the federal government.
And it creates real financial strain, especially for the local governments, but also the state. And so we will continue to work with our federal partners to make sure that the reimbursements are processed as quickly as possible. And then we'll have to wait and see what the impacts are for Hurricane Aaron to see whether we need federal assistance.
And of course, we'll know more in the coming days.
I mean, you just described all the stuff that the state has already been through. Now this storm hit when summer tourism is still going strong along the Outer Banks. What impact will that have on this industry there?
Yeah, well, we know that there were more than 2,000 people who had to be evacuated by ferry from Ocracoke, and thousands more tourists left the Outer Banks before the storm hit. So that's a lot of lost revenue for hotels and vacation rentals in a popular destination in the 2 weeks before Labor Day. Cape Hatteras National Seashore and its famous Spiral Lighthouse are closed. Most of the homes on the Outer Banks, as I mentioned, are on stilts so they can avoid flooding, but cars that were left behind could likely be flooded.
So what do forecasters expect from Aaron in the coming days?
Yeah, the rest of the mid-Atlantic and northeastern states are next. There are high surf advisories now all the way up the East Coast. And the farther north it goes, the less likely it will be to produce tropical storm force winds or flooding. But strong rip currents are likely, which brings us back to that warning to maybe just stay out of the ocean for the next few days.
Will Michaels with member station WUNC. Thank you, Will, and stay out of the ocean.
Thanks. You're welcome.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 5:42. Thanks for listening to the Thursday morning show on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up, Kari Headland and Malachi Coons will be your hosts. We'll have our early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin, at 6:20. Mostly sunny today, highs in the low to mid 80s, winds from the south up to 15 miles per hour. Showers possible overnight, possible thunderstorms too, lows near 60, and for tomorrow, mostly sunny and a bit cooler, highs in the mid 70s. Cooling down even more by Saturday with highs in the mid to upper 60s. Our listeners love supporting the businesses that support KAXE. If you are interested in connecting with KAXE listeners, call 218-326-1234. Ask for Peggy, Jen, or Chris. A big thanks to all of our current business supporters. You can learn all about bats at the Sac Zim Bog Saturday, August 30th from 5:30 to 9 p.m. There will be both indoor and outdoor portions of this presentation. Registration is required. Learn more at saczim.org/events. And the local chapter of the Experimental Aircraft Association has a pancake breakfast this Saturday, August 23rd from 8 to noon at the Grand Rapids Airport. Headwaters Music and Arts in Bemidji has a drum workshop and circle jam this Friday, 5:30 to 8:30, free and open to those ages 10 and up. Learn from two renowned teachers of West African drumming. I'm Jennifer Barr, and on a recent Monday morning show, we talked with longtime KAXE contributor and Minnesota Star Tribune columnist Aaron Brown. We talked about recent cuts to public media and what KAXE means to him.
So that puts it at more than 20 years, 22 some years of appearing on KAXE, and I've been privileged to you know, do the morning show, like segments like this, but also on the Great Northern Radio Show and Dig Deep. And when Heidi Holton was producing Between You and Me, I was a frequent contributor there for years and years. You may not think of KAXC as big time media, but I feel like that experience trained me. I mean, the quality that the station puts out of our programming is just amazing. And my experience, it was the fastest and easiest decision to spend money that we've had in our almost 25 years of marriage. She said, let's do
give
this.
Right now at KAXC.org. Thank you for your support.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its Sponsored Jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Faudel. A social media account for California Governor Gavin Newsom's press office is going viral. The X account mimics President Trump's style on Truth Social. You know the style. Using all caps, multiple exclamation points, coming up with derogatory nicknames for political opponents. There are also digitally altered images of Newsom that put him on Mount Rushmore and have him being prayed over by Trump allies like Tucker Carlson, Kid Rock, and an angel-winged Hulk Hogan. Basically, he's trolling the president. Is it a strategy that's working? To talk about this, I'm joined by Professor Jamie Crenn. She's a media and psychology professor at Columbia University and Sarah Lawrence College. Good morning, and thank you for being on the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So these posts are clearly getting traction. What is it about them that's resonating?
They're short. They're punchy. It's plain words. Clearly, the caps always make us think, hey, this person's yelling at me, and can you believe us? Can you believe this? The conversational style is just what draws people in.
What do you see as Newsom's goal here?
I think his goal is to get attention. It's to stay relevant. It's to make sure that his message is getting out there in a way that can attract a wider range of constituents and calling attention to what needs to change or what we need to bring our attention to.
Are these posts effective at accomplishing the goal of policy, though, what needs to change? And
so keeping up that energy is difficult. It's, you know, keeping a high volume. It's keeping a, you know, high cortisol level inducing of stress to make the policy relevant or equate the policy communication effectively. You have to question the credibility. If someone's constantly yelling at you, you have to think, where are they basing this? Is this more based on emotion? Are they really looking at facts, figures, and research?
And at this point, I mean, it's a lot of poking fun, it seems like, making fun of the style of President Trump. But you said it might not be a long-term strategy, but the president, President Trump, has done this for years, and it seems to be working for him.
It seems to be working for him and getting attention, but it's been going on for so long that the credibility is, you know, still questioned. You are gaining your followers. You are gaining that side, that team of, you know, joining in and getting on the same message. But it's also in some ways alienating the other side because we don't know if we can trust what the administration is putting out in their messages. So there's questioning of, you know, trying to make this effective.
Steve Bannon, the Republican strategist and podcaster, told Politico that tactics like this aren't going away and are likely to get more intense. So is this what Americans are in for, this sort of yelling on social media?
I think so. I think this formula is working. The short, punchy style, plain words, extreme emotions, the outrage, the humor, and then the triumph, adopting this meme-like tone with snappy, sarcastic visuals. It is framing, you know, getting more traction out in the news. And I think it's just what we are going to have to wade through in the future to understand the true message.
Jamie Crenn is a professor at Columbia University and at Sarah Lawrence College. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
I'm Chelsea Perkins, news director at KAXE. Every day, our team brings you trusted local stories because rural Minnesota deserves to be heard. But Congress voted to rescind $1.1 billion from public broadcasting. That's $228,000 KAXE counted on, now gone. It's 13% of our budget and supports everything from news gathering to emergency alerts. If you value what our newsroom brings to you, the voices, the depth, the community, now's the time to act. Go to KAXE.org or text DONATE to 218-326-1234. Support local news. Support KAXE.
The word from the Wyoming mountains on interest rates.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. Customers can simplify their insurance needs and protect what's important by bundling home and auto. Learn more about bundling at progressive.com. And by LHH. LHH, a global talent solutions company, combines craft and care to make work beautiful. Recruitment, development, career transition. Learn more at lhh.com/beautiful.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. It is like a summertime Super Bowl for people focused on the economy. The big meeting of central bankers kicks off today in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell is set to speak tomorrow, and we'll be watching for hints about borrowing, jobs, and inflation. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has this look at one tricky part of that equation, the cost of rent.
When prices started shooting up in the pandemic, rents followed suit, peaking at nearly 9% inflation year over year. Rent increases have moderated since then, but less than prices overall. Higher interest rates should have suppressed demand for goods and services, keeping a lid on rent increases. Columbia Business School finance professor Boaz Abramson went looking for a reason rent inflation was so stubbornly high, and here's what he found.
Higher interest rates get reflected in higher mortgage costs, and that prevents people from becoming homeowners.
Those folks stay in rental housing, competing with other renters.
Low-income households, they are impacted by the fact that first-time buyers remain in the rental market and overall increase demand.
Bottom line, higher interest rates pushed rents higher. But now?
Interest rates have dropped a bit. And we do see that rent inflation has somewhat dropped.
Online housing site Zumper tracks rents currently being asked in the market. And as of July, says Tongi Luluwarn, its national rental index showed year over year.
Both one and two bed rents were down. The first time since February 2016, we've been flat or declining across the board.
And he says the fall in average nationwide rents accelerated this month. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We're also covering President Trump's latest salvo aimed at a member of the Federal Reserve. He's called for Fed Governor Lisa Cook to resign, pointing to something about a mortgage she once took out. Cook has now responded, quote, I have no intention of being bullied to step down from my position because of some questions raised in a tweet. She said she's going to gather accurate information on her financial history to answer any legitimate questions. More in the Morning Report podcast feed if you miss it on the air. Markets S&P futures are down 0.4%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering a small ship experience with a shore excursion included in every port and onboard cultural enrichment. Discover more at Viking.com. And by the United States Postal Service, offering stamps for purchase at over 40,000 supermarkets and drugstores and at wholesale clubs, Costco, Walmart, Sam's Club, and BJ's.
Given crypto-friendly Washington, the biggest of U.S. banks are considering ways you might be able to put a crypto contraption called stablecoin in next to your checking or savings account. But does the word stable mean stable? As part of our ongoing coverage of the crypto shift emerging, let's turn to Stacey Marie Ishmael, executive editor of crypto and digital payments at Bloomberg News. Great to have you back.
A pleasure to be here.
So stablecoin, it's a genre of cryptocurrency that's hard pegged to the dollar, not supposed to fluctuate. Other than sounding crypto cool, this is going to be a hard question, Stacey Marie. Does stablecoin do anything for anyone?
Well, the clue is in what you said about it being pegged to the US dollar. A lot of other cryptocurrencies, famously Bitcoin, for example, move a lot, you know, 5%, 8%, 10% in a day. Stablecoins are designed to stay steady at a given level. And for people who, for example, want to avoid currency fluctuations or who want to have access to the US dollar, this is really attractive. So right now, I would say the most popular consumer-facing real-world use case is things like remittances. So for folks who want to send money overseas, that's a big use case for stablecoins right now.
Well, let me just put it another way. If you want to buy an egg salad sandwich, you could use $4 bills. But why stablecoins at all? Let's say you wanted to do a remittance from a foreign country. Just use a dollar.
Well, not everybody has easy access to dollars. And the argument made by some of the folks that are trying to, I would say, innovate within stablecoins and remittances is one, that the fees are a lot lower if you do it via stablecoin, that it's increasingly integrated into popular apps. So in the US, for example, PayPal has its own version of a stablecoin, and it's pretty quick. In some cases, it's instantaneous. Whereas for more traditional forms of remittances, you can be looking at, like, you know, 48 hours to up to 5 days in some cases.
Now, you and I are talking at a moment when the biggest banks in the universe, including Bank of America, Citigroup, among others, based on changes brought about by the crypto-friendly Trump administration, are thinking about allowing stablecoin into regular accounts. Like, part of your regular bank account might include stablecoin?
The key word there is might. Like, nobody is doing that at the moment, but it's certainly one of the things being discussed. Because again, the idea, you know, being pitched by these crypto companies is that they want this to be another accessible form of money in the same way that the dollar is. And for that to actually be true, you do need a way in the, like, retail branch banking or online banking context to have this show up next to your accounts. And there is quite a lot of lobbying happening by various, you know, bank lobby groups to help make this possible.
We should be clear. Do you imagine a universe in the United States where federal deposit insurance would cover a crypto account?
That is one of the more, I would say, contentious discussions now. I mean, we are actively in a regulatory environment in which you're getting the feedback that, you know, crypto should be showing up in people's retirement accounts, and it's something that everybody should be exposed to and investing in. But the regulators themselves are, you know, looking at the risks, because this is, unlike the US dollar, generally a more risky asset. And so saying that the US government will bail you out if something terrible happens to your crypto account is, for a lot of people, something they're still trying to get their heads around about how that would work mechanically.
Stacey Marie Ishmael is executive editor of crypto and digital payments at Bloomberg News. Thank you so much for the briefing.
Thanks for having me.
And in Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
It's just before 6 o'clock. You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. There is more ahead from Morning Edition from National Public Radio at 6:20, our early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin. He'll let us know what's been happening on our area lakes. Mostly sunny today, highs in the low to mid 80s, winds from the south gusting up to 15 miles per hour. We do have a chance of rain tonight, possible thunderstorms, lows near 60, mostly sunny tomorrow, highs in the mid 70s. Support comes from Great Lakes Aquarium with its new exhibit.